Thank you. And we're going to try to do this because there's six panelists, and I'm going to try to speak as little as I can get away with because Jeff Pribor thinks that I talk way too much, I think. Why don't we just do this really quickly? We're just going to go down the line. Say your name, the company that you represent, and the part of Tankers that you're in, and then we'll just go really quick. Okay, Kenny, you think we can pull that off? We're going to start with Bart.
Okay. Bart Kelleher, President and CFO of Ardmore Shipping. We're in product and chemical tankers.
Nailed it. Perfect.
Carlos Imotola, CEO of D'Amico International Shipping, and we are in product tankers.
Product tankers.
Lois Sabraki, I'm CEO and President of International Seaways, everything from Vs to MRs.
Eric Cannell, President and CEO of Stena Bulk, and we are into Suezmaxes, MRs, and stainless steel 20,000 tonners.
Harry Kosmatos, co-CFO at Tsakos Energy Navigation 10. Anywhere from VLs to smaller handies and everything in between, plus shuttle tankers and LNG.
Afternoon, Ted Petrone, Vice Chairman, Navios Maritime Partners. Like Harry said, we're VLs all the way down to MRs, so crude and product.
Excellent. That was well done by all of you. I think you all deserve a nice round of applause for not getting carried away. The next question, again, to be brief, last year, and most of you guys have exposure in various segments, but at very least you're going to have one of these. Last year, VLCCs averaged a little under 40,000, MRs averaged mid-20s. Just so that we're all on the same page, and appreciating that first quarter was a little bit below that, your outlook for this year, above or below where we were last year? And we'll go in reverse order, so we're going to start with Ted. Above or below where we were last year?
Can you tell me what President Trump's going to say tomorrow before I answer it?
See, I knew somebody was just going to not play by the rules.
I would say, look, so far year to date, we're at the last 2 year averages, which is well, it's around or above the 20-year averages. There's a lot of things in play, but if things stand today, I still think we're going to be close to the 20-year averages. But crude and products.
Here. It's my turn, right?
There you go.
Overall, we are in a healthy market. Supplies in our favor. The new buildings, the order book is quite contained still. So I would say, and not to dwell on it, perhaps somewhat lower from last year, but in terms of asset values, more or less at the same level, which tells you that people are confident that the market will stay at relatively healthy levels going forward.
Okay, and I mean, from my point of view, I think we have a lot of deliveries, especially on the clean side this year, and I cannot say that I'm have felt much good feelings in the start of this year, maybe a little bit right now actually, but nevertheless I think it's going to be a very tough summer, and I definitely think that particularly clean side will be lower than last year, and also the crude side will be lower, but still okay, it's going to be decent levels.
I think you're new to these panels, Eric. You can't say lower. No. Joking aside, you know, the first quarter, you know, we started out lower year over year. The days that we have booked into the second quarter are actually stronger than the first quarter. And one of the things that, you know, Ben, when you talk about Vs having been 40,000 per day, what's so significant is that the mid-size crude is matching those Vs. And it's just you continue strong on Suez and the Afras, and the MRs just keep cooking along.
So, just to be clear, up or down?
Up on crude, and sideways on products.
Okay.
No, just to clarify, last year on the spot on IMRs, we actually were on the low 30s, so we were higher than what. Yeah. So. Yeah. No, but this year, Louise was mentioning, I mean, the first quarter for product tankers especially was was weaker than what we witnessed last year, which was exceptionally strong. We are seeing a better market now over the last few weeks, but there's a high degree of uncertainty, and it's very difficult to make predictions at this stage. But I would say because of an acceleration in deliveries in the second half of the year especially, I would, if I had to make a forecast, I would say slightly softer this year than last year, but still a very good market.
You're last.
All right. I mean, it is an interesting point that seasonality isn't playing out how it typically does, and that you're seeing this strength in Q2 and as the refineries come back and ramp up their utilization. I think to the point, as we reported our year-end numbers and then the forward book, it was, you know, slightly reduced versus prior year, but still, you know, really within ballpark. And I think the way that we think about it is relative to the break-even of our business, which is down to like 11,500 per day, that, you know, we're ready to withstand a lot of uncertainty and have upside. So I'd say that, you know, it's, you know, close on a year-over-year basis, maybe a little bit of a notch down, but still really interesting relative to break-even.
Okay, so generally speaking, close to flat to maybe a little up. This is maybe the most bearish I think I've ever heard a tanker panel be, to your point, Lois. And I think very clearly the reason is we, and this has come up, we're sort of in uncharted territory. The way that I thought about doing this, usually when I do these tank or any shipping panels, I want to talk about demand, I want to talk about supply, and I want to talk about capital allocation. But in this particular case, there's a fourth category that is geopolitics, and it is the Wild West at the moment. And it's been discussed all day long, and I don't want to belabor it, but could you maybe, and for this, whoever wants to go first, as it relates to the USTR and Chinese ships, some people don't have any, but some of you do. Are you doing anything preemptively, or what do you do now? Like, is there anything you can do but sit and wait? Anybody? Sitting and waiting. Got it. Oh, wait, hold on.
I would say that, you know, sorry.
No, don't go
ahead. you know, I think dry takes the worst hit. Containers can spread out the cost, even though it's inflationary. And the tankers, you know, it's like a bell curve for the USTR with the Chinese vessels. The amount of Chinese vessels built is not so low at the top end, but it bulges in the middle with the IFRS and the LRs, and it drops down dramatically in the MRs. So it doesn't affect the products coming out of the States. I think a lot of the Chinese ships, the Vs, will not trade to the ships. I do think the disruption is not as great as feared going in.
Famous last word.
I don't know if I entirely agree, because I think that I saw this. I didn't do this study myself, so I don't know how precise it is, but from a broker, which mentioned, as initially proposed, there would be only 23% of the tanker fleet, which would be free to call the U.S. ports without any type of fees. If that is the case, and considering that 70% or even over 70% of the current order book for tankers is being constructed in China, we do have a problem, and the problem is going to become even starker going forward as these vessels are delivered. So I think it would be dramatic in first place for the U.S. economy, which would be inflationary. It would penalize export industries. I don't see this going forward as currently proposed. I sincerely hope that the comments which were provided by the various stakeholders at the hearings that took place are going to be considered, and that a revision of the plan is going to be presented, which hopefully maybe affects only vessels still to be ordered. I think that would make more sense if the objective of this regulation is that of penalizing Chinese shipyards for strategic military reasons, because there is a fear of the strength of China in this respect. So,
and I think we need to eventually some sense needs to prevail, because why are you doing it? Is it just to kind of tax people coming into the U.S. with the Chinese-built vessels, or in reality to promote and support the U.S. shipbuilding program? Because in order to do that, you just cannot do it overnight. And I mean, I have some data here. I mean, today the order book, 70% dominated by China, 3,500 vessels. The South Korea, 700 vessels, and the U.S., 25 vessels. The capacity, the shipbuilding capacity of China is 200 times more that of the U.S. And they're building vessels at a fraction of the price that you build in the U.S. So as you can imagine, in order for the U.S. to become a shipbuilding powerhouse, it's a generational kind of movement. You just cannot build a yard overnight. So eventually, I do believe that some sense will prevail, and it will not be as taxing to world commerce. I mean, we in tankers, we're not really that much impacted. It's primarily, as Ted mentioned, dry bulks and perhaps the dry bulks MRs in the crude side I was talking about, and LNG. So, and obviously the liners and the containers. And in the end of the day, who will be more affected? The U.S. agricultural producers, the U.S. Oil exporters. Who will carry all that volume of oil that the new administration wants to flood, you know, Europe and parts of Asia? Eventually, you do need those Chinese vessels. So if you make it prohibitively expensive to call into the U.S. ports, then if there is no other way as other than creating problems internally with your own workforce and other ancillary businesses around ports, and the congestions that this will create, because obviously companies, vessels will, especially containers, will limit calling into multiple ports and just stay in one, and that obviously will create many problems, many logistical problems around that. So it will be a mess.
If we look at it, you know, it does seem that, you know, that this initiative has bipartisan support. Exactly,
because everybody blames the new presidency, but actually started with a prior administration.
Correct. And if you look at, you know, the United States reduction in our building power, I mean, it has been tremendous, you know, over my entire career. And it seems like it will persist in some form, but what will 90 days later and 6 months later look like, you know, versus day one, I think it will evolve once, you know, everyone realizes all the different layers that are involved in, you know, just even on the tariff side, right, on the containers, you know. So are you going to continue to call all these ports, or where are you going to reduce, right? So it's going to impact the American citizens as well. But to me, it seems as if there will be some type of a bill, you know, more formalized, because it does have the support of the American both sides of the House.
And I'll let you go. I was going to say, Lois, you're a graduate of one of the U.S. Maritime Academies. You sailed.
Yeah.
Is this something that, if there was a greater emphasis, this is leading the witness a little bit. Do you think that the U.S. government can do something that is, you know, impactful as it relates to U.S. shipping?
Oh, absolutely. You know, of course. I mean, but you have to have dedicated resources, to your point, in order to scale it over time. You know, we didn't lose our shipbuilding capability over 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. It's been, you know, steadily eroding over the decades, right? So, of course, you can lend support, but that would have to be, you know, multiple different year period, right, in order for you to have a sustained momentum.
And the manpower, who's going to work on these shipyards? Does the U.S. today have the skills, the capabilities to build vessels of, you know, highly technological designs? Probably not. Over a period of, I don't know, decades, absolutely. But I don't think it's something that that could happen again overnight. And again, that's why I think this idea is, in my book, is doomed to fail in order to support the USC building.
Yeah, and I have to say, I mean, it is what it comes down to, who does it help or who does it disturb? I think it's the end user who will suffer, and of course the end user is in U.S. and in Europe as well, because I think and this is not a U.S. problem, it's a European problem as well, where shipbuilding has basically disappeared and everything has moved over to Asia, and with that, it is a joint problem, and I don't think we will gain anything by putting tariffs on Chinese ships. We have to make up our mind ourselves and start to build ships again at reasonable levels. I mean, I got a quote last week from a very known broker building a Suezmax in U.S., and I'm not sure if they even build something here like that, but the quote was $500 million. So if that is true or not, I'm not sure, but I don't think it's that far away from the truth, and who can make sense out of $500 million in this market?
And imagine the freight rate that you need to ask in order to justify that investment.
Exactly.
Of course, there could be ship owners who don't have any Chinese ships. What would they think, do you think, Bart?
I think you still have to be thinking about it, of course. I mean, so sitting with our Korean and Japanese-built fleet, I think I echo the panelists where it adds friction to the trade. And when it adds friction to the trade, in general, that's supportive of market. And in particular here, where, to Carlos's point, it's such a large percentage of the overall fleet. And so when it's that case, usually then it does become, you know, component of the voyage cost. And we've seen this with fuel regulation and other regulations. And so for us, it's thinking about the fleet today and then just making sure that we're actually positioning and would be pricing voyages appropriately relative to the global fleet, including Chinese vessels, so that you're earning, you know, an even better spread. Thinking about Eric's comment, too, I wonder what shipyard was potentially going to build a Suezmax in the U.S., because it's quite a size vessel for the U.S. yards.
NASCO could build it, right? I mean, we've got U.S. flagships that are Suezmaxes, only like, you know, 5 or 10. But, yeah, they can build it at NASCO for a cool $500 million.
Thank you.
Maybe.
Something we don't like to say out loud, but I think a modification of the Jones Act might help. Sorry. That you can lower the cost for the consumer by allowing the U.S. flag to buy foreign flagships, and you know, there's all these penalties come involved. If you're going to bring the cost up on one end, maybe you can help lower it on the other end. I'm just trying to think out loud of how they're thinking in Washington, which is hard to do.
Eric has ships that are built foreign in the flag U.S., right?
Yeah, should we talk about that? by the way, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
No, we have Chinese built ships that are U.S. flag, you know. And I'm sure we're not the only one. But what will happen with those? And I don't think I have the answer, at least. But of course, very interesting case.
But to me, you know, if you are trying to accomplish an objective of building your sea force, and you don't have the scalable capacity on a dime ready, absolutely, to Ted's point and your actions already, that's a way to supplement your sea force with whatever, you know, quilt you can put together until such time as you do
scale. At least on an interim basis, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
By the way, there was, you guys probably all know, there was an LNG carrier that was just reflagged to be U.S. flagged, and wow. And there is already an exclusion in that. I think it's over 30 years old, and you can reflag it to U.S. And so Crowley did this, and as a function of that, they're able to serve Puerto Rico. So, you know, there's always loopholes. And speaking of which, what were you going to say?
Well, so I think just, you know, building on the seafarer point from Lois, you know, that it's a challenge today. I mean, half of us up here went to U.S., maritime colleges, and to actually attract that next generation and have that viewed as a career, and the perspective of that relative to the international seafarers. I mean, we have a a JV with Anglo Eastern, and I was at their Maritime Academy in Mumbai in mid-February. They get 20,000 applicants for 450 slots, and you kind of do the quick math, and you're like, wow, in the U.S., it's easier to get into Harvard than it is to actually have a seafaring career and train in India. And that perspective, though, really powerful, where, you know, the academies in the U.S. Are still attracting, you know, have a difficult time attracting the talent.
That's a good anecdote. I'm going to use that. All right, so we don't know what's going to happen with that, but one of the things that is definitively happening are tariffs. And I think one of the things that is certainly it's an unknown but isn't focused on enough is the ultimate impact that tariffs might have on the global economy. And then in the case of this panel, what that might mean for oil demand and you know the need for tankers. Is that something you guys are at all worried about, or you think you're okay? Let's see who wants to do this one. Harris, I could tell you wanted to answer this question. You think the global economy is okay?
Well, you want to talk?
No, sorry.
No, I mean, the tariffs itself, you know, I mean, I was listening to another broker last week as well, and, you know, the tariffs themselves, what will it mean for the shipping industry or the tanker industry maybe in particular, and it will be disruption, and if we're, maybe that's what we like, because the market will go ballistic here within the next few months when the tariffs is kicked in, and because you know, the logistics around it will of course change again, and it usually takes 6-8 months and everything is sorted out in respect to logistics, but you know it's of course it's going to hurt again the end user at the end of the day, and before then we will of course see a situation when the market, the freight market is going up, and then probably the oil as well. It depends on what tariffs we're going to have on oil. But all in all, it's quite messy right now, right? It's very difficult to actually know exactly what's going to happen, or quite far away from exactly.
I would add to that I think that, you know, the uncertainty that we are going through right now because of all the threats that are being made on a continuous basis is already affecting consumer sentiment, business sentiment, investments, and of course it's going to contribute to a slowdown in economic growth, which will affect oil demand growth too, and you know we cannot say that will affect our market positively, unfortunately. It is true that the tariffs, it depends on how they are put eventually. So if they are across the board and if there's an escalation of tariffs by countries that are being subjected to tariffs, it will be a disaster. If instead it is only on certain countries, and in particular I'm thinking here Mexico and Canada, which are neighboring countries and very important trading partners to the U.S., both on the crude and on the products, then yes, it can create some inefficiencies which can actually be positive for the market. So, but, you know, the devil is in the detail, and it will depend really on how these are applied eventually. But in the meantime, they're not positive. All the situation is not positive.
That's a good answer.
Yeah, it seems to me the short-term disruption, you know, indeed does tend to drive our spot markets. And then in the longer term, it's going to take GDP off the table, right? Mm-hmm. So that would be my assessment. And the other point is, you know, earlier today, I'm talking about, you know, what gets rewarded over time, consistency, constancy. You know, right now, while we're sitting here, there was, we probably missed something on a tariff, right? So it's, I think for many countries, you know, if they can't, you know, rely on us as a partner that's, you know, okay, maybe they're going to look for longer term homes like Mexico for some crude. Maybe some of the TMX barrels out of Vancouver will go increasingly to China. You know, I think there's going to be a lot of flex in the system while this evolves.
Yeah. I'm going to do something different now. Just to kind of, you know, shake it up a little bit. We could go directly into talking about supply, and I know there was some real desire to talk more about
NAV, right? Or he was wanting me to talk about that. But why don't we actually, if we could, just to keep things moving a little bit, we'll intersperse questions in here. So does anybody have any, I don't know, questions about demand or how they're thinking about tariffs or anything like that now, and then we'll move on to the next part? Okay. That wasn't a good idea after all. Fine. Let's talk a little bit about maybe from a demand perspective, reasons for optimism. We all know that global economy and tariffs and these things have the potential to be disruptive. But are there any things that are out there that from a not necessarily supply, so not talking about that order books or that sort of thing, but are there demand type scenarios where that you guys can imagine that could either create much longer ton miles or cause absolute demand to go up materially? Any catalysts or reasons for substantial hope?
The macro, you know, let's start with the base. The macro trend is all the discovery in the oils in the West and all the demand growth in the East. So that's been a ton mile for crude lately. Many of us got into the product sector because the product sector ton miles were growing, starting to grow 20 years ago, almost at double-digit rates because, again, of that same thing of the refineries going out east and having to bring it back. So like in dry, you know, China has imported the same amount of iron ore every year, but you had some good rates on the dry side because of there's a ton mile issue. And I think a lot of people forget about the ton mile issue, IMO reducing speed. So there's a whole bunch of other issues that are on the, you know, outskirts, but I do think a lot of those are positive.
Yes, and there are two situations that we should be closely monitoring today. One is the Iranian situation, and if that eventually ends up in reducing and eliminating their exports, eventually, and most of that oil was going to China. China and India. So should Iranian barrels get off the market, eventually they would need to be replaced by places, you know, far away from those discharge ports. So that could be additive to ton-mile demands, you know, from the Middle East, from you know, South America and the likes. So that's something that could potentially be positive for the industry in terms of ton-miles. Plus, the recent reversal of the OPEC Plus cuts, which are releasing more oils, more barrels into the market. We still have a long way in order to have a total reversal of the cuts, which were somewhere in the 2.2 million barrels per day. From April, 130,000 barrels will come back into the market, and I think the plan is to gradually, over a period of months, to eventually and make up all those lost barrels since 2022. So again, that could be additive in terms of demand and seaborne trade.
I always think we have to remind investors we're volume driven, not price driven. So they see the price of oil going down, they think, well, there's not going to be the transportation. But you know, go back to after Lehman Brothers, China was soaking up all the natural resources they could for the next 2 years because they realized probably in the 20 years from then, they wouldn't be able to get this kind of price again. So, again, you said about India. The joke, unfortunately, the joke about India all those years was, it's the country of tomorrow, and tomorrow it's the country of tomorrow. But I think its time has come. I mean, they're doing very well in their oil consumption and importation compared to China.
I think I'd just add also on the chemical side, you're seeing the new capacity come on and it's built for export, and that's actually encouraging trading entities and even other oil majors to now actually engage in arbitrage plays and chemicals and more specialty products. So you're seeing an additional volume that in the past would only move systematically under contract that actually is adding a layer of demand. And I think you still have a lot of headwind there, you know, whether it's biofuels, specific chemicals, and things that can benefit the smaller tanker asset classes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so
I have one other point if we want to add. No, I think that the path to a peace agreement in Ukraine is far from certain. I mean, certain days we seem to be getting closer, and there's talk of certain sanctions being lifted, and other days there is the opposite types of announcements and threats of tougher sanctions. What we have seen, however, in the last few months is a greater sanctioning by the U.S. But also by the Europe and the UK of vessels, not only involved in Russian trades, but also in Iranian trades and in other sanctioned trades generally. Especially when they are targeted by OFAC, these vessels have a very hard time continuing to trade. And we already have 320 such tankers specifically sanctioned, and the list has room to grow further, because if we look at the Gulf fleet today, it's anything between 800 and 1,100 vessels. So there's room for more vessels to be specifically sanctioned. And if that were to happen, that would be very positive for the market.
So good job by you for jumping the gun and stealing everybody else's thunder. So now we can talk a little bit about supply. And obviously the big catalyst, I would think, is – as it relates to Russia and the potential for, all of these ships that Carlos was mentioning to, not be available for trade. But I don't know. I'm not supposed to give open-ended questions. But is there any additional color that you guys have? I mean, this is the most exciting part of the whole tanker area, in my opinion. Now, I could be wrong, but how are you guys thinking about the potential catalyst that, and frankly, I think that's putting my analyst hat on. If you're looking for a reason for the stock price to go up, that's probably it. Like, investors in shipping have a binary view of it. Either they want to own it or they don't, and it's going to be a catalyst that causes them to do that. And so you need that catalyst, and I think the only apparent catalyst in shipping at the moment is Russia. So let's hear about it.
It's not only Russia, it's Venezuela, it's Iran.
Yeah, it's true.
Right? So, to Carlos's point, you have a big OFAC list, and, over the weekend, United States said, okay, not only is Chevron, we're not going to bring in the barrels out of Venezuela, Sargent isn't going to do it. Well, what does Sargent do? They lift very heavy crude, and they lay down paving and cement, right? So one of the products that's been tough to get has been heavy crude, right? So you it does seem that you're starting to see on the market, Afras, Suezmaxes, really kind of strengthening. And then when you move up the chain, India more so thus far, not taking necessarily sanctioned tankers, and all of a sudden everybody looking a little bit more closely than I think they were 3 months ago at your certifications, your insurance, your trading, and how much you've turned your AIS off in the last couple of years, and whether or not you've been a transparent player in the market.
Yeah, and I'd say at the same time, those vessels – in general, or at least a really significant portion, haven't been properly maintained. And to Lois's point, not in the same insurance, class issues, flag, regulatory bodies. So the ability of them to actually come back into the global fleet is challenged, even if it is, changed and acceptable from a regulatory standpoint. So I think you have just a massive scrapping candidate that is a huge catalyst.
Now, playing devil's advocate a little bit, generally speaking, those assets don't operate at the same utilization levels. Is that fair? So is there a way to maybe frame in a utilization-adjusted removal if it does all materialize?
Exactly the point I was going to make, man, was that I think the utilization rate on these vessels, let's say it's 75. If they don't get scrapped, maybe it goes down to 25. So 100 million deadweight will act like 30 million deadweight.
Okay. And by the way, did I miss any other major catalysts out there on the supply side? Like, the order book is not tiny, but it's not big. Is there anything else out there that that you feel like, man, if this happens, then the world's going to be a very different place, and my stock price is going to be a whole lot higher?
Well, I think it's the edge of the fleet, and actually I'm reading here from our investor presentation, which I urge all of you to read. About 18% of the fleet today is over 20 years old. 46% is over 50 years old. It's just over three times the order book. So eventually, these vessels will get scrapped over the next year or two. And we have seen recently a pickup in scrapping activity. The market has been bifurcated. We have the Western trades, if you like, and the sanctioned, the Russian trades. These vessels, as very well pointed, they are not coming back. It's very tough. They are tainted. So I don't see any material threat of these vessels kind of jumping the fence and coming on our side. So by the time, you know, it takes for the current order book to deliver, we're going to have a very big number of the existing fleet exiting, departing the areas, the parts of the trades that we are participating. Based on the fact that, you know, it takes 2 to 3 years to build a vessel from the time of signing to delivery, the yards are running at capacity. Today, it's impossible to get a vessel before, you know, the second half of 27, if not late 27. So at least we have 2 to 3 years of a runway to know how demand will shape out. And as things look today, things are, you know, quite positive on that front. It's just impossible to overbuild, especially with, you know, the debate on alternative fuels, vessel designs, and what have you. You don't really know what would the vessel of the future be. So in a way, that pulls the brakes on overordering.
To back up Harry's point, I think on the V's, you know, everybody got so excited or, you know, worried about all the order books. I mean, it was a record order book for V's being purchased last year, but the order books are 10% and the overage is at 20. When you get to the Suez and LR2s, maybe somebody can back me up on this, but I think the order book and the overage is about the same percentage and the same with the products. So you only have replacement value going into a stricter environmental regulation world.
Exactly. No, I will add to that. To those points, only that the what we discussed previously, which is the fees, which most likely are going to be in certain form, yet to be decided, applied to Chinese vessels or vessels controlled by Chinese companies calling U.S. ports. This situation is going to reduce the appetite for ordering vessels in China. And we mentioned over 70% of the tanker order book today is in China. And there's very limited production capacity outside of China for tankers. So if something happens, and it looks likely that something will happen, then I think that the new building market will be extremely tight because people will be extremely reluctant to order in China and would need a very, very deep discount to do so.
It was a perfect lead in. You read my mind. In fact, it's still half of what I was going to ask. So now the question here is not, are you in the market to order a tanker? But if you were in the market to order a tanker, and we're just going to go yes or no on this, would you be willing to order one in China?
Based on everything we know today, right now, I would say no, and no based on pricing level too. They have to adjust it.
Okay, now this is not about pricing. We'll get there, but just Korea versus China.
Korea.
Okay. Carlos?
Yeah, we have four vessels that we ordered in China. So, and I must say that I was surprised by the how good the specifications of these vessels are and how professional this particular Chinese yard at which we ordered is. So, but of course, this regulation is extremely impactful, and we have to see the details. But no, in the currently, we wouldn't be willing to order more vessels in China.
Yes. We've got 6 on order in Korea. We did that consciously, worried about China for other reasons, but are glad we did.
No, and I have to say, with what we know today, it's I mean, the safest bet is for course Korea if you would order something, and yeah, it's it will be a price issue for us, but and I'm sure that this will not last for that long, and the tariffs, what kind of tariffs will we actually see at the end of the day? But I think it's going to be bigger problems than what anyone expects if this is coming to be enforced to the level that we are discussing today. So Korea.
Okay.
It feels like a speed dating panel here.
So
quick answer, Korea, I mean, in a pro forma fleet of 82 vessels, including the recent order on the 9 shuttle tankers built in Korea, we have 2 Chinese vessels in the water, which came along through an acquisition of an original company that we have effectuated last year, and a new build in 5 Panamaxes and 2 MRs built in China. So we will refrain. In any case, we are not big advocates of Chinese vessels. These were more opportunistic kind of orders. But I mean, the majority of our new building program historically has been Korea and Japan, and I think we intend to remain in that kind of category.
Ben, I want to make sure I don't get in trouble here. You're asking me, right, personally, what I would do.
That's right.
Okay. I would do half and half because China has the quality and the pricing advantage. And I think 3 years from now, when the ship delivers, all this tariff issues will shake out.
Well, I'm glad we got a different answer. So 5 no's and 1 half and half. So we'll take it. Now on to the next question. Based on asset prices today, would you... Do you think they're too high to be ordering, or do you think that secondhand assets are too high, or they're really attractive here? So today, right now, good price or not good price? We'll go in reverse order. Ted, you were creative last time, so good price or not?
Terrible price. Too high. Much too high.
Much too high. Got it. And that's a good negotiator.
Too high for speculative ordering.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely too high.
All right. I would tend to agree. I mean, when you look at, you know, over 20 years, you know, you're at certainly the higher part of the cycle. Second, you know, on new build costs, right, and secondhand values. And yet, you know, when you look at our share price, everything's come down so much already that, you know, like a reduced price is already reflected. So, you find opportunity all along the chain, all along the curve, and maybe we'll get there soon.
Yeah. The prices are high relative to historical averages, without a shadow of a doubt. It depends on how some of the factors that we discussed in the panel today will play out. Of course, whether it is a good timing or not to buy, and it depends also on what your holding period is, right? So if you're buying a very young asset and you still have many years ahead of you, then irrespective of what will happen over the next few years, you will probably find a good opportunity to earn substantial amounts on the asset and dispose of it profitably. So we are not looking to buy now because we already invested substantial amounts over the last few years. I think it depends on what asset you are buying, how young the asset is, and what your holding period is.
It just doesn't make sense to me that you could buy, which many of us did, buy these 10 years ago and you can sell them for the same price today without inflation just rearing its head just recently.
Yeah, I think the way we're thinking about it, too high, but then I think you do also have to look at it on an inflation-adjusted basis. And if you do that, then the second-hands coming down to a place where, you know, perhaps like another leg down or so, you know, you could start to actually carve some value. But there does seem to be a greater stickiness at the new build level.
Okay, so we're going to stick with this theme here. So you have, and some of this has already been answered, but I'm going to give you three options. Okay. Either you can use, $100 million. You can use $100 million and you can keep it in cash. You can buy a tanker. And if so, say what kind of tanker that you look to buy. Or invest in a professional sports franchise, which, you know, hey, Bart, which sports team would you?
I grew up in Buffalo, so Buffalo Bills all the way. I do think that there should be a fourth option. Investing in your existing.
I should have said. Fleet. You're not allowed to say you can buy your own shares. That's off the table because everybody thinks they're cheap. So this is either you keep it in cash, or you buy ships, or you buy the Buffalo Bills.
Yeah, well, always buying the Buffalo Bills, but but I would say, in addition to a new vessel, just incremental investment in your existing fleet. In terms of energy efficiency, I think that actually pays, really interesting returns, and is something that you should just be doing through the cycle, regardless.
All right, I'll let that one slide.
Can you hold on to the cash a bit? And
that's keep the cash. That's one of the options.
Okay. So I think that given we already invested quite a bit, as I just mentioned, I think we would delever a bit more the balance sheet. And then opportunistically wait for an even more interesting window to make further investments.
All right. Modern secondhand V. And one of the things we were talking about earlier with the catalyst, at first I was like, how are we going to impose 25% on Venezuela? We don't own their oil. Well, that's what you do to anybody who buys it, right? And if that were to materialize on Iran, it's going to get interesting real quick.
There we go. All right.
Yeah, no, I listened to both leaders, and I have to say that investing in existing ships sounds maybe like the way to do it. There you can probably make a calculation around efficiency and get something back. To buy a ship today, no, I will not do that. In that case, I just keep the cash.
Probably buy a five-year-old VL. With that amount of money, have it in the spot market for the next year or two, and then see how it goes. But I think that's probably the best investment to take advantage of the positiveness that we feel that the market will generate over the next year or two.
The problem with coming up through the trading side, like I did, if you give me $100 million, I want to trade it, I want to spend it. But sometimes the best trade a trader makes is not doing anything and holding on to the cash. My second pick is I'd buy some pickleball franchise or circuit. It's got a high upside, I guess.
Okay. All right, pickleball. Good. So we have two people buying modern VLCCs, and then doesn't sound like there's any conviction around any other specific asset types. Is that fair? All right, good. So now we're going to go back to the Q&A, and let's see if anybody has any now. Okay, well. Oh, good. Thank you. Can you? I'll repeat the question, by the way. Okay, the question is, do you have a view on propulsion and dual-fuel tankers? And, Bart, are we going to be using ammonia anytime soon? Or
I think sort of just I think the realities of the world in our customer base pushing energy transition out further. So I think when it comes to engine technology and fuel distribution, it feels like that actually is going to take longer. And then comes back to then, so if you're focused on what you can do today, invest in your current fleet for efficiency in conventional power, but that also gives you a seat at the table for as the technology, you know, will naturally evolve, so that you kind of still have that hands on what the vessel of the future might be.
Anybody else have any conviction? I know, Lois, you guys have some LNG.
I think we're not the only ones.
Exactly.
We've got our dual fuel Vs, three of them that are running on gas, and so I'd say dual fuel LNG, and then our LR1s are, extra generator strength and strengthened decks, and our project cost anticipate that we would have to plan to make them dual fuel in first or second survey, and then keep that flexibility.
We have six dual fuel LNG in the water, which ironically it makes us one of the largest dual fuel owners in the world today with that fleet. We're not here to experiment. Today, LNG seems to be the alternative that has lasting powers. So we will see, we are monitoring all other alternatives, and we'll, when the time comes, we will address the issue. But we have never been kind of a first movers in new untested technologies, and we will refrain in doing so again.
Yeah, and you can always do experiments, and I think we, from our point of view, we love to do experiments, but at the end of the day, of course, it has to be financially viable as well. We are into methanol, and we tested different things, I think someone mentioned distribution is definitely still a quite big issue, and of course the pricing of methanol and ammonia and what have you, and then of course technology is still developing, especially on this ammonia engine is I don't think anything is out yet. Methanol engines are working, of course. LNG is definitely working, but it's a long way to go. And since this was, I would say, a hype for a few years ago, a lot of things has happened in the world, I think ship owners, we are very good at finding solutions in respect of energy efficiency. And look what happened since 2008 until now, when fossil fuel or regular fuel that we use for many years, I think we are at least 50% more efficient today, and will that continue? I think it will, actually, and will it solve itself until 2040, 2050? Yeah, I'm positive. I think that's going to solve itself as well. With the biofuel combination, with fossil fuel, and maybe some alternatives as well, of course.
And the majority of the order book, it's still conventional fuel, right? Something like 70% of the order book. So the jury is still out. So we'll see how that kind of.
The answer is almost to take care of the ships that are already in the water. We're in three different segments. It totals 28,000. 28,000 ships, 10,000 TEU, deadweight or higher, or 1,000 TEU. And I think the order book is 3,000. And those aren't coming for 2 years, so they're not polluting today. So there's a lot of research going on. There's a lot of joint ventures. We're looking into, doing the energy devices on the vessels, the longer dry docks, more costly dry docks to get the ships more efficient. We've been watching the airlines and the U.S. oil companies, because the oil companies are heavily investing in carbon capture, and I think LNG/carbon capture could be part of the, as you said before, it's going to be a combination of things. You need methanol and ethanol, I'm reading about now, gas stations around the world before you can get it done. The airlines have a space issue, right? We can create space for the higher density fuels. They cannot, so they have to use biofuels. So I think that's going to be a big answer. That's where I think the breakthrough will be. Watch the airlines, watch the oil companies, and see what happens there.
Mr. Bornos, this is your conference. You can ask whatever you like.
Given the new administration policies on the energy transition, that may not be the priority right now. So a lot of these charters cargo owners are U.S. oil companies. So do you see your customers focusing on energy transition when it comes to southern groceries? Or is your commitment to energy receiving your own initiative for energy efficiency and cost savings?
Okay, so the question is, as it relates to energy efficiency and new fuels and all those things, is it something that your customers are pushing, or to the extent that you're doing it, is it sort of an internal thing or something to comply with the regulators?
Well, we have seen there are some customers. We have seen, for example, Total. They developed a project with some ship owners, our peers, which involved dual fuel green methanol vessels. We did not participate, and one of the reasons we did not participate is we don't think this is a viable solution for many years for our sector. It did involve long-term contracts, so you know, a large part of the risk was taken on the shoulders of the charterer. But generally speaking, there, you know, apart from a few cases, I'm not seeing a strong push on behalf of our clients. Of course, efficiency is very important. I mean, they want efficient vessels, and they will pay more for efficient vessels.
I mean, we have an order book of 21 vessels. Seven of which, as I mentioned, were built in China speculatively, so they do not have currently any employment attached. The rest do have, and we never felt, and these orders were placed prior to the new administration. There was never any pushback on propulsion systems. Conventional fuel was the most dominant kind of design that our charterers kind of wanted.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say, I mean, our vessels were pretty much all spot, and I think the focus always has been on safe, reliable transportation. When it comes to energy transition and energy efficiency, I mean, I'd argue that it's just good business in terms of, you know, creating efficiency, reducing your energy bill, and increasing your performance. And where you have that alignment, I think sometimes we get hung up on what nomenclature we refer to it as, and even, you know, going back a long time ago, we wouldn't have called it energy transition, but it's still good business. And I think that, you know, it makes sense regardless.
So just to we're basically out of time, so just to recap, you feel okay about the market, maybe a little worse, but not really bad, maybe a little better, but not really better. But generally speaking, there's a lot of uncertainty, so it's hard to have a whole lot of conviction about one direction or the other. You have no
interest. Perfectly said, Ben. Perfectly said.
Thank you. You have no interest, with the exception of Ted, from ordering anything from China. Generally, things feel a little too expensive at the moment. And if you're going to be investing, it's probably investing in making your businesses better. Is that a good summary of where we are?
I mean, you know, one of the things you're talking about, Ben, you know, when, you know, I think every owner here on the panel, you know, when you talk about efficiency and everything, you know, you start with maybe defense, which is would be regulation, right? IMO regulations, you know, that's the baseline, and every owner is running their fleet and then looking at, okay, well, what can I do to be more efficient? And then you go beyond just the regulations, and especially where it's good business, and you look for customers to be partners where you can find them. And trust that the oil companies are always looking for their best bargain. So often if they're looking at a time charter, you know, you're going to, you know, the more efficient ship is going to get the early bird gets the worm, right? So the more efficient ship is going to win out.
All right. Well, with that said, let me just say, Nicholas, thank you for inviting me, and thank all of you guys for participating. I think hopefully this was a helpful conversation, and it was something other than just sort of raging bullishness, which is, you know, a good, thoughtful discussion, I think. So appreciate it from all of you guys.